In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Sin, depravity and corruption. These are the words that are most commonly linked to the Borgias, the Renaissance family with the most immoral reputation of them all. But to what extent is that reputation fair? In our latest Everything You Wanted to Know episode, Professor Jill Burke helps to find the truths buried amidst the scandals surrounding the Borgias, from rumours of incest and the decadent Banquet of the Chestnuts to the forgotten triumphs Alexander VI had as Pope. Asking the questions was Kev Lotchen, section editor of History Extra and deputy editor of BBC History Revealed.
Today on this Everything You Ever Wanted to Know podcast episode, we're going to be discussing the Borgia, one of the most infamous families of the Renaissance. And joining us to explore this topic is Jill Burke, who is Professor of Renaissance Visual and Material Cultures at the University of Edinburgh. Jill, welcome to the podcast. It's absolutely great to have you here.
Hello, it was nice to be here.
As with all of the episodes in our Everything series, the topics we're going to be talking about today are based on questions submitted by you, our listeners, and also the top Google search queries. Jill, first off, the Borgias, I wonder if you could ground us a little bit. Where and when in history are we? And, you know, who are the Borgia? And in a nutshell, why are they famous?
Right. So we're right in the centre of Renaissance Italy. So I suppose people who are around at the same time as the Borgia were people like Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Machiavelli, and who we'll probably be talking about later. And the Borgia are mainly famous for having a member of their family being a pope, Pope Alexander VI, and him being a pope that I suppose has become quite notorious for doing unpopely things, like being involved in murder and bribery and other shenanigans that we can talk about. So that's basically why they're famous. And they existed at a time when Italy was at war. In 1494, the French invaded Italy in order to take control of the Kingdom of Naples. And it was a very, very unstable time politically. So this is a background that we have to understand the Borgia against, that it was a time when there was a lot of intrigue, a lot of backstabbing, sometimes literally, and where, you know, power was changing, fortunes were changing really, really rapidly over about 50 years, from around 1494 to the end of the Italian Wars was in 1559. But the first, you know, 30 years were really dangerous and difficult times for the plots and assassinations in Italy. So that's when the Borgias held their most power.
And you mentioned Alexander there, and we, you know, we'll talk a lot about him and his children, Cesare and Lucrezia, but I wonder if we go back a little earlier to start with. A couple of questions we had in, one from Zepresendo, another from The Golden from Golden, both on Instagram. And they kind of basically ask, how do the Borgias come to prominence, and particularly into Italy, when, if I understand it right, they're originally a Spanish family?
Yeah, that's right. So the Borgia family is a kind of a minor aristocratic family from Valencia, which is now in Spain, then in the Kingdom of Aragon. And they basically come into power because they're really good administrators. It sounds a very unpromising start. You know, oh, they're so exciting. Actually, they're just really good at admin. So we'll get to Alexander in a bit. But the first kind of famous member of the family is called Alfonso. Alfonso Borgia, and he was born in the late 14th century in Aragon, and he trained as a lawyer, and he was very good as a lawyer, and he entered the service of the King of Aragon, who's annoyingly also called Alfonso. There's a lot of Alfonsos in this story. That's Alfonso V of Aragon. And our hero, current hero, Alfonso Borgia, acted as a diplomat. He worked in Naples. You know, there's a very, as I said, kind of very turbulent things happening in Naples at the time. And Alfonso V wanted to take over Naples, and eventually he did. So he did this in the 1440s. So we've got this position. The King of Aragon's just taken over Naples. He's got this Borgia guy as his, you know, one of his closest administrators, someone he really trusts. At the same time, the papacy in Rome is establishing itself. The Pope hadn't been in Rome for much of the 14th century, and Rome was really became a bit of a provincial backwater. Then, the beginning of the 15th century, the popes come back to Rome and establish themselves as the one true papacy after the papal schism. So, the popes are really interested in trying to get alliances with powerful rulers. Does this make sense? Everything in this period has got a lot of kind of political machinations in, so it can get a bit complicated. So the Pope at the time thinks, oh, well, you know, now the Aragonese kings, the kings of Naples, I better get them on my side. So what they do is make Alfonso Borgia a cardinal, right? So he becomes a cardinal, and then, quite unexpectedly, really, he becomes elected Pope in 1455, and he becomes Pope Calixtus III. So this is when the Borgia family really become very important in Italy, and it's all because this Alfonso Borgia was a really important administrator. And then what happens when he's Pope, and this is very common, he has a couple of nephews, and he makes them cardinals. So, and then the nephew that we're interested in is called Rodrigo. Rodrigo is the son of Calixtus's sister, Isabella, and he makes him a cardinal. And that's how the Borgias, as they, you know, the notorious bits, part of the family, as we know them, that's how they became established in Italy.
You mentioned as part of that they were very able administrators. So one thing on Instagram, the Jumping Jacks wanted to know is how rich they were at that time and what kind of, where their wealth came from. I mean, this is assuming they had wealth. I mean, how might they compare, say, to the Medici?
Their wealth mainly came from the church, right? So they, I'll look at Rodrigo, because he's, you know, became Alexander VI in the 1490s. And he started, he was made a cardinal at 25, but even before that date, he'd been a canon of cathedrals. He'd got benefices in Spain, and he just kind of accrued a lot of church positions, and with them came money. And so most of their money came from the papacy and came from this way. Now, the Medici family, they were bankers, right? So they ran an international banking network, and they were wealthy through trade. So they have, they're both wealthy families, but the Medici wealth was much more solid. And we'll find out, because the Borgias, one of the problems with the Borgias is because they were so reliant on this role in the papacy, right? And this is why they kind of went up in fortune and went down in fortune really quickly. Whereas the Medici wealth was based on an international banking network. They were lending money to, like, the King of England, King of France, all these kind of things. And actually, it turned out that those connections and the wealth that the Medici had was much more solid. Their family was built on much more solid foundations.
We'll talk a bit more about the Medici a bit later on. But in terms of the popes then, so you've got Calixtus III. He makes his nephew Rodrigo a cardinal. Rodrigo will go on to become Alexander. How does Rodrigo rise to that position?
Rodrigo is, as I said, like 25 when he becomes a cardinal, so very young. But he's soon, like, he's really good, again, at administration. And Calixtus makes him his vice-chancellor. And that means the vice-chancellor is the person who takes care of all the administrative stuff at the Vatican. So he's like the right-hand man of the Pope. And this is 1455. And he just stays as vice-chancellor because he's good at it, even after Calixtus dies. So Calixtus is only Pope for 3 years. And then he dies in 1458. But Rodrigo Borgia stays as in this role as vice-chancellor in the Vatican right through the next papacies. And he's still the vice-chancellor after the death of Innocent VIII in 1492. Now, no one expects Rodrigo to become the next pope, particularly. He's not like one of the hot candidates in the conclave in 1492. But what happens there is that there's two major factions. There's a pro-Neapolitan faction, and there's a pro-Milanese faction. And each of them have different candidates. And there's a bit of a stalemate, and neither of those candidates can get elected. And so Rodrigo, partly because he's not from an Italian family, right? So he's separate from all this. And they know he's a good administrator. He's like a safe pair of hands. What happens is that the Milanese faction, led by Cardinal Ascanio Sforza, say, all right, okay, we're going to back you now. And so then he gets elected to the papacy and becomes Pope Alexander VI. There's also a certain amount of promises of money involved. And, you know, there's a lot of rumours about this conclave being extremely corrupt. But a lot of the conclaves were decided through influence, through, not even if not exactly bribes, through promises of benefices, through promises of church wealth. So it's not necessarily more corrupt than other Renaissance conclaves. even though, you know, after, you know, posthumously, the Borgias get a lot of stuff thrown at them, and their reputation gets very bad indeed.
We will talk more about their reputation,
yes,
as well.
We
So Alexander becomes Pope. Lots of people would like to know things about Alexander. So Callum Papworth on Twitter, he asked, yeah, it would be great to get an understanding of whether Alexander's womanizing behaviour was so different to the behaviour of the popes of the 15th and 16th centuries. So, I mean, could you give us a bit of an overview of what exactly Alexander gets up to that starts getting him this rep? I mean, presumably as well, he's quite a different pope to his uncle.
Yeah, I mean, Calixtus was only pope for three years. So in some ways, he doesn't have quite such a time to build up a reputation as Alexander. The Renaissance papacy was different to the papacy today. And it doesn't really make any sense unless you really kind of take that on board. So it's not just a spiritual power. So the popes in the Renaissance are, like the popes today, the spiritual leader of all Catholics, right? And, of course, this was before the Reformation, so that's a very large amount of people indeed that spreads over most of Europe. But they were also temporal leaders. They were also secular leaders and were kind of like, I suppose, kings or princes, and had and ruled over a lot of central Italy. And this part of central Italy was called the Papal States, right? So it included places like Bologna and later on Imola and places like that. So they had this dual kind of role. And this is true of all Renaissance popes. So it's not just Alexander at all. So his successor, Julius II, who hated Alexander, was also like a massive military leader and wanted to expel the French out of Italy, and was also very, you know, really big on war and not like, not Pope-like as we'd, you know, understand it today at all. So that's different. As for the thing that everyone knows most about Alexander is his children, right? And that he had a mistress, a series of mistresses, actually, and he had children. A lot of Renaissance popes had children. So Pius II, who was a pope in the late 1450s, had two children. Pius III had children, Julius II had children, a lot of them. And they're all illegitimate because, you know, you couldn't get married if you wanted to be a pope. And what was different about Alexander VI is that he was really intent on getting his children to create an inheritable wealth, right? So when you're the pope, you have access to a lot of the wealth of the church, but it's not your family's, right? So when you die, the wealth goes with you. And in this period, getting your children and lineage is really important, and passing on something to your children is massively important. I mean, it is today, but more so, right, in the Renaissance. And so what Alexander VI did was think, well, I've got these children. How am I going to pass on any of this wealth to them? So much more than other popes, he, you know, is interested in furthering the fortunes of his children, and he really adores his children, it seems, and he really trusts them in very, very important jobs. So that's what's different. He also is rather flamboyant in during his papacy, not just before his papacy, but during his papacy, having mistresses. So he gets a new mistress during his papacy called Julia Farnese, and he has a child with her. This is kind of scandalous at the time. And but Rome, it was like a kind of bubble, the Rome of Alexander VI, and a lot of the cardinals had concubines. It was at this time in the 1490s that the word courtesan or cortigiano in Italian was first coined, right? So it was very kind of licentious time and place. And what went on in Rome was surprising to people who weren't part of it. But it seemed to be quite acceptable for cardinals and things to have concubines within that kind of setting in Rome in the 1490s and early 16th century. So yes, he was, other popes also were not celibate, but Alexander VI was very not celibate.
So it wasn't entirely scandalous. It was just more of a step beyond.
I mean, arguably, he pushed it a little bit far. You know, things like he went away for a while. I think it was in 1501, and let his daughter Lucrezia take charge of running the papacy, right? For for those couple of months that he was away, and that was pretty scandalous. Because, like, that you're not meant to have women in the Vatican at all, let alone a woman who's effectively in charge.
And did the cardinals accept that?
People plotted endlessly against the Borgias. You've got to tread really carefully in all Renaissance courts, because if you go too far one way, you know, you're at the risk of ruin or death. You know, this is the way that Renaissance courts often operated. They're quite dangerous places once you get to a certain level. And so although this happened, you know, part of the backlash that happens to the family is because actually people were thinking, were kind of uncomfortable with this kind of behaviour.
We mentioned Lucrezia there. I think we mentioned Cesare very briefly earlier. One thing lots of people would like to know about, Liz Fulson on Facebook, Tess Smith on Twitter, Hannah K. Gelsness on Instagram, they all would like to know about incest, alleged or otherwise, between these two children of Alexander. Is there any truth to this? Is it just a rumour?
It's just a rumour. So it was a rumour that circulated. The idea of incest in the family was a rumour that circulated during their lifetimes, right? So it's not like something that's been made up by later historians. But and there's reasons for it, to do with Lucrezia's marriages, really. So Lucrezia was married three times. And the first time she was married was at the age of 13, which in itself is very shocking to us. It wasn't that uncommon for aristocratic families to marry off their daughters as soon as they hit anything near puberty, though 13 is particularly young. And in her first marriage, she married this guy called Giovanni Sforza. He was part of the Milanese family, you know, the Milanese faction, probably part of, like, Alexander thanking the Milanese faction for supporting his papacy. And but what happened is that Milanese faction started not to become useful to the Borgia after a few years. And so they wanted to annul the marriage so Lucrezia could get married again. And Alexander said, well, let's annul it on the basis that the marriage was not consummated and that Giovanni Sforza is impotent, right? And so Giovanni Sforza said, well, I'm not that keen on this idea. And then he started to say that Lucrezia was in an was having incest with her dad, with her father, with Alexander VI. So this is where the first rumor of incest is from, that it was between Alexander, between actually the Pope and his daughter. But there's clear reasons why this rumor was being spread, and it was kind of like a, you know, a kind of battle of lies, essentially, around ending this marriage. But he did, Giovanni did eventually say, yes, I am impotent. He signed documents, legal documents to that effect. He was kind of bribed into doing it and persuaded by members of his family. And then Lucrezia married again. And she married another guy called Alfonso. Alfonso of Aragon, lots of Alfonso, as I said. And she married, and she was married to him for about 2 years, and it seemed like politically the right thing at the time. Then it stopped being very soon stopped being politically the right thing. And Alfonso was murdered, almost certainly by Cesare or by the Borgia family. He was stabbed in Rome on the steps of St. Peter. I mean, this is pretty scandalous. On the steps of St. Peter's, he didn't die. He brought to be recovered in papal apartments, and then he, as he was recovering, he was strangled. And I think it's this, right, kind of fact that people think, oh, it must be a crime of passion by Cesare because he loved his sister. But in fact, it's just political, right? It's just political. Cesare was pretty ruthless, a pretty ruthless figure. And they needed Lucrezia to forge other alliances. And she went on to marry the Duke of Ferrara, who was called Alfonso. So she was kind of like, she was really young. We're talking about a really young girl at this time. And she, at this time in her life, she was quite a pawn in the family, you know, these dynastic shenanigans. But I don't think there's really any proper evidence. It's just these rumours spread by people. A lot of people hate this family for various reasons. And so there's a lot of rumours. And this incest thing becomes bigger because of the, like, fictionalisation of the Borgias that you start to see, particularly recently, but also in the, like, 19th century and various times after since fall, really.
That's such an expansive answer, thank you. And hopefully that answers Jen Kerry's question on Instagram, who just wants to know much more about Lucrezia. One follow-up from that, which comes from Kaf Casper on Instagram, was whether Lucrezia was a villain or just a victim.
Right. Okay, so we've talked about the bit of the light of her life when Lucrezia was really a victim, I think, you know, of just circumstances, being part of this massively powerful family, being part of this shifting system of alliances during the Italian Wars. But there's, and I don't think she was ever really a villain, but she was really cool, right? Because she gets on. Lucrezia's great. There's been more recent work on her in the last 20 years by historians who have looked at more documentary evidence of what she did when she was in Ferrara. So she spent the last 17 years of her life or so in Ferrara. She got quite a lot of power there. She deputised for Alfonso when he was away. But she also was a really shrewd businesswoman. She set up her own mozzarella business. So she sets up this business. She buys loads of water buffalo, loads of land, and she pawns some of her jewellery. And she sets up this really successful and shrewd business person. So she's not just a victim. She's not really a villain, but she is quite an interesting figure in her own right. But all that stuff has been a little bit subsumed by this incest thing. But yeah, she's great. She's one of these. There's a lot of very, very cool Italian aristocratic women hanging around in the early 16th century, and Lucrezia is one of them.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The Vatican under Alexander VI was different. There were more women in it. He was more ambitious for his family, and he was more open about it than other popes, and that's the key difference.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Let's talk about Cesare. What can you tell us about him? Just a brief overview of who he is and how he fits into the Borgia story.
So Cesare was the son of Alexander, and he was either the oldest son or not, because we're not sure of the date of birth of his of another son, Giovanni. And he was a cardinal for a little while and then suddenly wasn't. And he was never suited, I don't think, to be a cardinal. He never wanted to be. And then after his brother died, he was also murdered. He was found in the River Tiber with stab wounds. No one knows who murdered him. It could have been Cesare, but I don't want to say for definite, because who knows? It's not very fair to say it was him. So after that, he became really the kind of big hope for Alexander as a secular ruler. And he sent out Cesare to lead a campaign to get various little tiny city-states under the Romagna and get them under papal governance. And that's what Cesare did, and he was very successful, very ruthless, kind of just toppled loads of these states, so these kind of statelets that were held by various ruling families. And he carried on doing that really until Alexander VI and him both got very ill, and Alexander VI died. Cesare didn't. He recovered, but by that time, because his dad had died, he lost a lot of the influence in Italy. He went over to Spain and to Navarre and was a military leader then, and eventually he was killed in 1507, so not long after his dad died, actually, in battle, I think by a spear wound, a siege in a place near Navarre. And so he had quite a ignominious death, really. Very, very steep rise and then very steep fall.
What was he like as a military commander? Kane Watson on Facebook would love to know.
He was determined and he was ruthless, notoriously ruthless. And this is linked also to his reputation, which was much enhanced by Niccolò Machiavelli, another, famous and sometimes much maligned figure from the 16th century. Machiavelli writes a lot about his ruthlessness in the book The Prince. But the very most famous thing that Cesare did is when his mercenary military leaders, which in Italian called condottieri, so the condottieri are kind of generals who fight, who are paid to fight for political powers. So he had some of these. One of them was called Vitellozzo, and they turn against him, right? So he's really successful, blah, all these states are against him. And then they start to betray him. And Cesare finds out about this, and he says, okay, it's all right, guys, come on, we can make up about this. And then they come back to him, he imprisons them, and then he has them strangled. And it's really kind of publicly shows, you know, what happens to people when they disobey him. Before Alexander died, it was looking like that they had their eyes on Tuscany. So all the Florentines were really, really scared that he was going to invade Tuscany and take over Florence as well. And so he was impressive. I mean, Machiavelli, what did he say? Machiavelli said about him that Cesare said, if you don't want me as a friend, you'll know what it is to have me as an enemy. And that's what the Florentines thought. They were terrified, basically. So yeah, he was a very effective military leader.
And soundingly from that and what you said before, very ruthless as well. This is a very specific question, but Delia Martland on Facebook wanted to know, could Cesare have had tertiary syphilis? And would this explain his behaviour?
Right, I don't think it explains his behaviour, right? Because I think he was just, you know, just this way inclined. You know, a lot of people, you know, I think you had to be pretty ruthless to have power in Italy at that time. And if you don't have, you know, this big family background like the Medici do, they're in the, you know, you're a newcomer, you have to be incredibly even more ruthless than everyone else. So I think that's why he was like that. He did also have syphilis, almost certainly. He wore a mask when he was in his later years. Apparently, after he was killed, they found him that he had a mask because half of his face had been eaten away by syphilis. Syphilis was very widespread amongst the Italian elite in the later 1490s and early 16th century. It was probably an illness from the New World. So it came in and, you know, spread really like wildfire amongst Cesare did probably have tertiary, by that point, by his death, did have tertiary syphilis. But I don't think we can blame syphilis for his behaviour.
Notwithstanding the fact that he may have only had half a face, two people have asked, Mike Gingras on Facebook and Nancy Buchanan on Twitter. They both want to know about the rumours that Cesare was in fact a body double for Renaissance depictions of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, this is a really odd one. And it just is not true. So Cesare was, born, but Cesare had a, I think the reason why this could come about is because Cesare had a beard, right? And fairly like long shoulder length hair. But if you look at images of particularly military people, in this period, particularly from Spain, everyone has the same hair and the same beard. Beards associated particularly with generals, with military men, this kind of thing. So beard's really fashionable. Shoulder length hair is just de rigueur. It's just what's in at the time. And so if you look at a portrait of him, you'll see, oh, that could look a bit like Christ to people who don't know that it's a fashion. But images, Christ was white with a beard and longish hair, and he was portrayed that way for centuries before Cesare was born. So it's just one of those really weird internet rumours, I think, that kind of gets gets repeated without people really looking at the evidence. So that's not true.
Speaking of things we find on the internet, one big Google search query is the banquet of the chestnuts, which I gather is Cesare's involved in that. But could you just break down what's going on here?
All right. Well, the banquet of the chestnuts is a famous party that happens in the Vatican in 1501, and it happens in Cesare's apartment. So it is kind of his party. And there's a proper source for this. This is true. And I have actually got it with me, so I can read it out if you like. And so this is written in the diary of this very dry and diary of the papal master of ceremonies. And he's normally like, oh, the King of France has to sit there and has to bow, you know, bow. And then the Duke has to bow. It's really boring diary, most of it. And then you get this entry, and this is the most famous bit. So it says, in the evening, in October 1501, 50 decent prostitutes or courtesans had dinner with Duke Valentino, that's Cesare, in his room in the Apostolic Palace, that's in the Vatican. And after dinner, they danced with the servants, the courtesans, and others there, first in their clothes and then naked. After dinner, lampstands holding lighted candles were placed on the floor around the table and chestnuts were strewed around them, which the prostitutes, naked and on their hands and knees, had to pick up. The Pope, the Duke and his sister Lucrezia were all present and watching. Finally, prizes were offered, silken doublets, pairs of shoes, hats and other garments for those who knew the greatest number of these prostitutes carnally. So basically, it was a massive sex party, which involved chestnuts. I mean, it should be said, this is not a common occurrence. They're not always having chestnut orgies at the Vatican, but this did seem to happen. And it's possibly from here that you get things like the chat about incest and stuff.
Well, so my follow-up is going to be, it's going to sound loaded based on the banquet of the chestnuts, but a bulk of questions on a similar theme. This one's from Nicholas Surges on Twitter, and he's like, depictions of the Borgia family frequently characterise them as corrupt, decadent and cruel. To what extent is it fair? And also, they ask, is it based on biased sources?
Yes, it's based on biased sources. Partly. So we've talked a lot about some of the things that the Borgias did. So, you know, Cesare probably had... did have Lucrezia's second husband murdered. He was a very ruthless military leader. But so were a lot of other people who were around at that time. Even if you just, you know, people might be more familiar with the Tudor court, right? So even if you look at like Henry VIII or then Mary Tudor or Elizabeth I, you'll know how vicious and dangerous it could be at the Tudor court. And it's the same in Italy. That it's just a dangerous place. You know, people did get killed, people did get poisoned in this period. The Italian Wars was particularly violent. There was lots of sacks of cities, lots of civilians got killed. It was a really, really dangerous time to be alive. Now, the reason why the Borgias perhaps have had fingers pointed at them so much is because they had this really precipitous fall from grace. So Julius II was a member of the Della Rovere family, and these were real enemies of the Borgias. So he was like, I'm not going to stay. I'm not going to look at, you know, Alexander VI's apartments, which are very fancy. We can maybe talk about them later, in the Vatican. I'm going to have my own apartments done because he's so appalling, such an appalling person. And so a lot of the history that was written about the period of Alexander VI's papacy was written by people who are his enemies. Or who, you know, like Florentines, like Francesco Guicciardini, or, you know, some of the accounts of some of Alexander's enemies. So a lot of it is biased. And also, you know, people tend to repeat the interesting and salacious bits, you know, of the story. I mean, we've talked about the banquet of the chestnuts, and it is, you know, rather than, which is a tiny paragraph in a massive papal diary full of events that aren't quite so interesting. So a lot of what the Borgias did just doesn't, like the, you know, the mozzarella farming or whatever, doesn't get repeated quite so often as the murders and you know, sexual intrigue.
Well, funny you do say that, and in the vein of mozzarella farming, James G on Twitter, he asked, did the Borgias do anything well? And then we got Franchise 505 on Instagram asked specifically about Alexander and what positive changes occurred in his reign. So we've got the scandalous side of the Borgia. What's the flip side of the coin?
Alexander was Pope for quite a while, and he did some interesting things. He did some things that were really massively important for the world. And because at the same time as Alexander was made Pope, right, 1492, Columbus was sailing the ocean blue. And so you get this whole new set of questions about the status of previously undiscovered lands, what was then called the New World. And so Alexander in 1493 brought in these papal bulls, made these laws that said that Spain had rights to these newly discovered land. So basically, it was Alexander. He split the world into a line, put down the globe that said, "Oh yeah, you know what's west of this line, Spain can have." So that's something that he did that had. I don't know if it was good. It wasn't good necessarily, but it was something that had massive ramifications. He was also, interestingly, and this is something that might surprise people, is he was also very interested in church reform. So he set up a little group of cardinals to look at church reform, and this included looking at new rules about church property, looking at how to make the cardinalate more moral, and making the clergy generally how to make the clergy stick to more moral codes. So there's that, and that's something that's often not appreciated about him. And he was the good, really good thing about him. Is that he was very, he allowed Jewish refugees who had then recently been expelled from Spain in 1492, because they expelled all the Jews from Spain in 1492, he allowed them to come to Rome. And this actually, because of a lot of kind of rampant anti-Semitism in the 16th century, this was one of the things that he was accused of. He was accused, and his son was accused of being Jewish after he died. So this kind of openness to taking in Jewish refugees backfired on him. But this was a really good thing that he did.
And how does the family's own heritage from being from Spain, how's that tie in with their relationships with other families on the Italian peninsula?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons they were really hated. Spain, in the 15th century, it had been relatively recently when it was fully Christianized. And there was a big Jewish population up until 1492 and a big population of converted Muslim people. So who were then called Moriscos, who were then eventually expelled as well. So Italians viewed Spain with some distrust. Also, the Aragonese presence in Naples was viewed with some distrust. Then later on in the 16th century, Italy becomes this kind of arena for fighting between the King of Spain and the King of France. So there's a lot of anti-Spanish sentiment. And one of the things that they, levelled against Spanish people was that they weren't proper Christians. You know, that they might be Jews, they might be hiding Jewishness, or they might even be hiding, the fact that they really worship Islam, underneath this kind of facade. And so the fact that the Borgias were Spanish really adds to the reason why they have such a bad reputation.
That being said, Inés Proença on Facebook asks whether the Borgias were worse than other families of the time.
I don't think you can say that the Borgias were worse than other families of the time. Alexander was more openly not celibate than other popes. That's true, right? But in terms of the murder being a bit murdery, right? Other families were also quite murdery at the time. So you'll see a lot of poisoning and a lot of executions, particularly in the context of the Italian Wars. So the Medici were really ruthless. So they're, for example, when they came back to Florence after being expelled in 1512, they were really, really ruthless against their political enemies. So you get a lot of people, being hung publicly and public executions, that kind of thing, when it comes to political enemies. So I don't think they were particularly worse in that point of view. But the Vatican under Alexander VI was different. There were more women in it. He was more ambitious for his family and he was more open about it than other popes. And that's the key difference.
The relationship with the Medici is the one that lots of people have asked, like just generally they want to know more about. How did these two families interact? Did they really interact, I suppose? You did mention earlier that at one point Cesare was threatening Tuscany and the Florentines, and of course the Medici were rulers of Florence for quite a number of years.
Right, so it's interesting because the height of the Borgia success comes at the same time as the Medici were having a really bad time. So the Lorenzo de' Medici, Lorenzo de' Medici is often called Lorenzo the Magnificent. He's like the most famous 15th century member of the family. He died in 1492. So another thing that happened in 1492 is Lorenzo de' Medici died. And he had a son called Piero, who was just rubbish. He was like a really rubbish member of the family. And when he was threatened by France in 1494, he said, You can have all our key fortresses, just do whatever you like. And because of this, the Medici family were actually expelled from Florence in 1494, and they were exiled, and they weren't allowed in Florence until 1512. So all that time, when Alexander VI basically is in power, the Medici weren't a massive power in Italy. They were kind of collecting in Rome under the patronage of Giovanni de' Medici, who later became Pope Leo X. So there wasn't this kind of, it's not this kind of battle for dominance that you might imagine between the Medici and the Borgia. The Medici were just really not very important at that time. It's only in 1512 when, with the help of Spanish forces, actually, the Medici force their way back into Florence, that their star starts to rise considerably again. There's not much interaction really between the Medici and the Borgia.
Is there any family the Borgia do have that kind of tug of war power struggle with?
Well, the Della Rovere, you know, who is Julius II's family, the Orsini, who are a big aristocratic family in Rome. All the people, you know, so we're looking at Rome here and looking at really the people who are jostling for the papacy. So it's those families that really are kind of angry with the Borgia, and also just all the, so you get, you know, as you know, I think, as we said, Italy is divided into lots of different city states at the time, and most of them are ruled by individual families, but some, like Venice and Florence, are still republics, are republics at this time during the Borgia. So they have governments. So all of them are trying to get the favour of the Pope, or intrigue behind the backs, their backs, so you can get another Pope in next and things like that. It's a massively unstable political situation. So all these families are trying, you know, either kind of lobbying against the Pope or trying to get on his side.
I mean, speaking of political intrigues, one more relationship that a couple of people would like to know more about, Kaf Casper on Instagram, Hannah Law originally also on Instagram, is Niccolo Machiavelli. We mentioned him briefly before, but how does his story tie in with that of the Borgia? And, you know, one specific question of, was he inspired by the family?
Yes. Yes, he was. Absolutely. He's inspired particularly by Cesare. So we've just talked about Florence, and Machiavelli was from Florence. And he was another bureaucrat, right? So he was like, we've talked a lot about people being good at admin, and this is Machiavelli's role as well. So he's like kind of notorious for being like apolitical and this political mastermind now. But at the time, he's actually quite a sympathetic figure, is Machiavelli. And he works for the Florentine Republic and really believes that in the Florentine Republic at the time, he's working for them as second chancellor. And while he's working in that role, he gets sent to see Cesare when Cesare is doing this military campaign in the Romagna in 1501-3. And Machiavelli goes to see him maybe three times as part of a delegation from Florence. And he is quite impressed by his ruthlessness. He's like, wow. In Florence has this republic, and everything is decided. Although they start to get a lifetime leader in 1502, a lot of stuff in Florence is decided by committee. And, you know, Machiavelli gets quite frustrated with this committee kind of structure. And it is frustrating if you read some of the Florentine deliberations. They just talk and talk and talk and talk. And so he's like, oh, God, you know, Cesare just decides things and he gets things done and he's very ruthless. And so in The Prince, Machiavelli's most famous work, in book seven, Cesare comes out as this kind of model leader, right? This is how you have to act. There's a very famous bit in Machiavelli when he says, if you're a leader, it's better to be loved than to be feared. But if you can't be loved, you better make sure that you're really feared, right? And this is what Cesare did. He just makes people really fear him. And So for Machiavelli, he's this kind of epitome of ruthless and effective leadership. But Machiavelli also notes that he's really dependent on his dad being Pope. And this is why when the fortunes wheel turns, Cesare just falls apart. So there's a bit of both things going on there.
Well, that's a neat little segue into what happens Witta Borgia after Alexander dies, and then we've talked a lot about Cesare and Lucrezia. What happens to the family as a whole after that? Those kind of two generations.
Right. Okay. So Cesare dies quite soon after. Lucrezia goes and does mozzarella, these other children died quite young. Geoffrey also dies in 1516 or 1517. The family kind of carry on being minor aristocrats in Spain, in Valencia. And I suppose they have, and I think they still exist right through today. You still get Borgias around, or certainly kind of descendants from that family, and they're still, in kind of noble, aristocratic kind of roles. The most famous member of the family actually became a saint. One of the Borgia relatives, I think he was his great-grandson, Alexander VI, went over to Spain. He was one of these minor aristocrats in Valencia, and he was an aristocrat for a while, and he got married, he had children. And then in his 30s, he thought, oh, I'm going to stop being an aristocrat, and I'm going to train as a Jesuit, in the Society of Jesus, which had been quite recently founded in the 16th century. It's this massive missionary order. And he did, and he was named as a potential cardinal, but he decided not to be a cardinal. This is Francis Borgia, or I think you'd say it in a Spanish way. I don't even know if I want to attempt that. Borja. He was really renowned for being holy. He was one of the leaders of the Jesuit order, and he became canonized as a saint about 100 years after he died in around 1570, I think, and he became a saint about a century later. So the Borgia family ended up all right, really, but they lost their prominence in Italy completely, and they weren't an important family in Italy after the death of Lucrezia, I suppose. Though her children, she had 8 children, and they went on to kind of join the ranks of the Italian aristocracy.
We certainly see the stories of Alexander, Cesare and Lucrezia told in pop culture. I guess the most famous one is the Borgias, the one with Jeremy Irons, but there's all other kind of depictions. I mean, how do you feel about these kind of shows in the way they depict family?
You know, I think a lot of historians who know the history of this period get really annoyed with people playing with facts. And that is kind of annoying in dramas. But I can understand why if you're creating a drama and you want people to watch, so you're not going to choose the bits when, Rodrigo Borgia is really making a good job of admin to show to audiences, are you? So I understand why you get like salacious rumours about Lucrezia and Cesare and things like that, and why that is something that... So I understand that. I get more annoyed when they get things like how underwear is depicted wrong, stuff like that. That's what really annoys me about films and TV programmes of the 16th century. It's like, oh, God, those sleeves aren't tied on in the correct way. That bugs me. I think people don't watch these programmes people who watch these programmes and enjoy them aren't thinking, oh, I'm reading a history book. You know, I think most people know the difference. I get more annoyed with people writing history books who repeat this stuff without thinking about the sources it's coming from. And as far as I'm concerned, dramatists can have dramatic license, and that's absolutely fine, apart from with the underwear. I watched the first, I haven't watched The Borgias actually, the one with Jeremy Irons, but I did watch the first episode because of this thing. I get quite cross with it, and I get quite unbearable to sit with my members of my family, like, oh, shut up. Because I'm like, oh, that's not right, that's not right. And I thought it was all right, actually. I liked the way that it had Johannes Burckhardt in it, and it had a lot of the names of people who were figures at the time. It was obviously really quite salacious and all that kind of stuff, but that's kind of what I expected. I don't get particularly annoyed by dramas being dramatic, but you do have to take it in historical terms, you know, you really do have to take it with a pinch of salt.
Do you know, one I watched recently was Leonardo. And Cesare turns up in that. But it did get me thinking, and no one's asked this question, so I'm going to, what the Borgias, how they approached patronage during the Renaissance, and if they were involved in that in the same way the Medici were.
One of the things that I didn't mention when I said, what Alexander VI done that was really good, was the Borgia apartments in the Vatican, which are great, right? So these were a set of eight rooms that Alexander had decorated by an artist called Pinturicchio. And they're really interesting decorations, and they're like really important and were very fashionable in the late 15th, early 16th centuries. So that was a really important part of art patronage. Now, Cesare was moving around a lot and was a military leader. So he did absolutely, I haven't seen Leonardo because it will, I think I'll explode from being too irritated by it. But he did know Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo da Vinci did work for Cesare, but as a military engineer. And the most like impressive thing that he made for Cesare is a map. It's a town plan of Imola, and it's now in the Queen's collection in Windsor. So it's in the UK, and the Queen's, the Royal Collection has a really, really great website. So you can, you know, Google it and that website will come up and you can see this beautiful town plan. It was one of the first town plans to be taken, to be looked at from above with an eagle eye view. And so it's actually quite an important thing that he did. But he also looked at fortifications for Cesare, looked at canals. And so he was basically a military engineer for him. But the Borgia apartments are really great and really underrated. Everyone's like, oh, I love Raphael and the Raphael rooms that were done, a few years later for Julius II. But you should go, if you're in the Vatican, go to see the Borgia apartments and you won't regret it because they're very beautiful.
And am I going to start? They were sealed for a time.
They weren't exactly sealed. I think that this has been a little bit over-egged. So Julius II said, I am not going to use those apartments. You know, my disgusting, horrendous predecessor.
And he was of that family who were arch rivals.
Yeah, he's in the Della Rovere family. He really hated the Borgia. And so he set up his own apartments, and that's the ones that Raphael painted with some paintings that are really famous. The School of Athens is probably the most one of the most famous paintings of the Renaissance, and you might not know what I'm talking about from the title, but if you Google it, you'll go, oh yeah, that one. Julius II had his own apartments, but they weren't sealed. You read some of the stuff online and it's like they were sealed with wax and like a big tape across it that said, do not enter. And that's not the case. So Giorgio Vasari went in, for example, to see the Pinturicchio frescoes in the 1550s, maybe. And people used them, cardinals used them to stay in. But they weren't open to the public, like the other rooms in the Vatican were, until later in the 19th century, until the 1890s. And it's then when art historians actually started to see these rooms for the first time and go, whoa, Pinturicchio, he was quite good, wasn't he? So you don't get this kind of sustained visiting into these rooms by people who were grand tourists and stuff like that in the 18th and 19th centuries like you did with the Raphael rooms. So they were sealed to that extent, but they weren't hermetically sealed or anything.
I mean, this has all been amazing, this chat. But before I draw it to some kind of conclusion, I should ask, what have we not talked about the Borgias that we probably should do in like the last few minutes?
I suppose, I mean, it leads on from, I mean, this is just a general point about history. And I think it leads on from what we were saying about, you know, the TV programmes, that it's really important to think about the sources that you're reading. I know this is kind of a boring thing, or maybe self-evident, I don't know. But the Borgias is like, the way that the Borgias have been treated in history is a great object lesson for being careful about believing everything that you're told. And that understanding that even if you've got primary source material saying something, that you need to know who is saying what and what position that they're coming from. And I think if you want to know anything about them, that's the most probably the most important thing, that, you know, you need to go back, you need to find the sources.
By way of an ending then, here's an open question from A and Tark on Instagram. What can we learn from the Borgia?
Well, I suppose. You can learn that if people are outsiders, they're likely to be maligned by the people around them. That if you gain power quickly, you've got to really watch your back. And that, you know, and not to trust, you know, accounts at face value. I suppose all those things you can learn.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
That was Jill Burke, Professor of Renaissance Visual and Material Cultures at the University of Edinburgh. If you enjoyed this podcast, then you might also enjoy another Everything You Wanted to Know episode from our archive, when the historian Catherine Fletcher joined us to speak about the Medici dynasty. Just search for Medici to bring that up. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.